Thank you very much. And I'm senior only by being oldest. Most of the work was done by Suk-Yung Chung, but she's sufficiently far along in her pregnancy that we thought her quality of care would not be favorably affected by being down here. Let me move on here. Okay. Most of the studies on pay-for-performance incentives focus on group-level incentives, and the results are generally mixed. Those that look at physician-specific incentives sometimes show that they work, but have never really compared physician-specific versus group-level incentives. And that was one of the kinds of things that we're looking at here. In addition, almost all the incentive structures have been put into place by payers. They, in essence, say, here's what we're going to measure on, here's what we're going to reward, rather than by clinicians sitting down and saying, what do we actually feel comfortable looking at? So I'll be talking about some of those aspects. Most have focused on claims data rather than medical record data. And also, there's always been a question about, well, if you pay the reward at the end of the year, is that good enough, or do you need constant reinforcement? That's the pigeon model. So basically, what we're asking here is, does a pay-for-performance program within a large primary care group practice improve quality of care? Does frequency of payment matter? And are there physician characteristics that explain variation both across measures and over time? So the setting is the Palo Alto Medical Foundation. It's a large, not-for-profit medical foundation, part of Sutter. It contracts with, in 2007, three independent medical groups that only work with the medical foundation. Think of a Kaiser-type model. One of those groups is the Palo Alto Division that has five sites, actually not only Palo Alto, goes all the way over to the East Bay into Fremont. The physicians are essentially based on a relative value unit measure, even though about a third of their patients are capitated. The Palo Alto Division has been on electronic health records, the Epic system, since 2000, so they actually know how to use it. And they implemented physician-specific incentives in 2007. This was their choice, not a payer-driven choice. In essence, what they decided to focus on was all the primary care physicians for all of their patients. Now, in California, we have the Integrated Healthcare Association that's been using pay-for-performance measures focused on the patients in the health plans that are part of IHA. That's roughly about 30%+ of the PAMP patients. The Palo Alto doc said, no, we want to practice one style of medicine, as we heard, for everybody. And so they used their own resources to provide incentives based upon all of the patients, not based upon which kind of a health plan the patient had. In a little bit of research, we randomized the doctors into a quarterly payment versus an annual payment, but we didn't feel comfortable, and they didn't feel comfortable, with holding information from the clinicians, so they all got information every quarter on how they were doing. And I'll give you an example in a moment of how that looks. And they were, the maximum bonus was roughly $5,000 a year, which is 2 to 3% of their income. The quality measures are both outcome and process. I'll show them to you in a moment. 10 of these were existing measures that had been reported for at least the last 3 years. There are 5 new pediatric-focused measures based upon various ACP guidelines. As they got into using them during the year, they decided they didn't like the way they were defined, and they changed them. Just little tweaks around the edges, so we're not going to report on any of the pediatric measures. This is what happens when you're doing research in an operating organization. They do what they want, which is good, which is good. And so the quarterly reporting, they got an email alert that said, click here, see how you're doing. And once they got into that thing, they could see not only how they were doing, but how every one of their colleagues was doing. This was not de-identified from the physician perspective. They used their own funds to supplement the IHA.
By name.
By name. Right, not just Dr. 22. Who's 22? Okay, they got to know who it was. All right. These are the outcome measures that were incentivized. 3 of them were outcomes for patients with diabetes, hemoglobin A1C, blood pressure control, LDL control, et cetera. You can see the list. Some of them are relatively reasonable process measures, like long-term controllers prescribed for asthma patients. Some are sort of, you know, did you actually write down height and weight? Okay, and since the electronic health record, they actually have all that stuff tracked, you can see the list there. These are some of the measures that were not incentivized, many of which look like the ones that were, but they're less stringent. In other words, the IHA goal was hemoglobin A1C under 8. The PAMF docs felt that that wasn't good enough. They wanted it under 7. So, of course, you'll see a much lower success rate for their patients, but that's because they actually have a more stringent criteria. Here's what the distribution of physicians look like. We didn't show the names here. This is physician 1 through physician 67 within family practice. They set their guidelines and goals. They, in essence, said to get even 1 point, you've got to have at least 40% of your patients meeting that hemoglobin A1C target. Between 40 and 50%, you get that 1 point. Above 50 and below 75, you get 2 points, and you get 3 if you're over 75%. Okay, this was not based on high science. This was physicians deciding what they wanted to do. Okay, no, I would not have chosen those cut points. This is what the dashboard coming back to an individual doctor looks like, and I checked, and they didn't seem upset with putting his name in. And so Dr. Duncan is actually doing better than his department for both the hemoglobin A1C 8 and the hemoglobin A1C 7 measures. And this is tracked over a number of different quarters. You can see the number of patients on which it's based, et cetera. And so he can then even drill down and see the patients in the list if he wants to do that. The incentive formula, and this goes back actually to the first presentation, they worried a lot about how do you figure out the formula. When they're using their money, they worry about it. So they looked at the number of achievable points for each measure, the number of patients. They said you got to have at least 6 patients within a category before we even count that score. So doing 100% on one patient, that just doesn't count. And you don't get any rewards if you don't have at least 4 qualifying measures in the quarter. So again, they were worrying about some of the small numbers that we're hearing about in the QBP studies. Number of physicians, total of 167 distributed across the various departments and various locations. So what we see here is the number of physicians meeting the criteria for the minimum number of patients is typically in the mid-hundreds. Now, that number is going to be a little bit squishy, as I'll point out later, because it includes the pediatricians. Remember, all of the pediatric scores were dropped. So these are the pediatricians who have patients with adult measures, like chlamydia screening, et cetera. So they're going to have small samples for many of them. A number of eligible patients per physician, you see the means there. For some, the numbers are very high because almost all the eligible patients height and weight in their panel. And you can see what the average scores are over on the right. So the question here is, does a P4P program with physician-specific incentives improve quality of care? Simple question, complicated answer. So what we see is the average scores are improving each year between 2005 to 6 to 7. Makes sense. And actually between 6 and 7, there was a significant change in each one of the scores. However, the rate of increase only improved for blood pressure control for patients with diabetes, colon cancer screening, and tobacco history being entered. It actually seemed to get worse for LDL control for patients with diabetes. When they dug into this, it actually wasn't getting worse. They changed the lab equipment. So all the cholesterol scores changed a little bit, which made it appear to be worse. So that's why it's there, we report it, but don't believe it. Well, believe it, but just interpret it correctly. For the non-incentivized measures, we see sort of the same story, which is not surprising because many of these are subsets of the things that were being incentivized. Looking across the three groups, remember, everything that I had previously been telling you was about Palo Alto. In Santa Cruz, the incentives were brought down to the department level, i.e. family medicine, peds, and internal medicine, but not down to the individual physician level. In Camino, it was just kept at the overall group level, okay, which is probably much more common in most places. My take on this is we can't make a good argument that individual physician-based incentives are markedly better than whatever else is going on. Okay, so we can make nice graphs. Does the frequency matter? Obviously, every quarter, things are getting better with the exception of asthma, but you could argue that they're well above 90 plus percent. They're doing pretty well. They're probably not going to get better than that. Screening for chlamydia is not very good, but people say, well, maybe the denominator is going to be very hard to get. And since some of these young adolescent women are still coming in with their moms, they're not going to say that they're sexually active and therefore need to be screened. So I'd say there's essentially no effect of frequency on payment or on the bonus amount. That argues perhaps that physicians don't respond to periodic incentives the way pigeons do. So what about physician characteristics influencing these things? Short answer, if you wanted to get the highest scoring physicians around within the Palo Alto medical, within the Palo Alto region, find yourself a woman physician who's been there a while. They tend to have higher scores. The best predictor of scores in 2007 were what you got in 2006, which is consistency is nice. And the change in scores, basically nothing was going on. Again, ignore the pediatrics line because those are based on essentially a very small subsample of their patients. What we find here across measures is that, not surprisingly, tobacco and alcohol are highly correlated, the scores on that, because essentially they're screens next to each other in the Epic system. If you're going to respond to one, you're going to respond to the other. That's what we see, and that's what you'd expect. On the other hand, controlling blood pressure for patients with diabetes seems to bear no relationship to controlling their hemoglobin A1C. So there's something else going on there, and we just don't know what that is yet. And likewise, screening for colon cancer bears no relationship to managing diabetes for your patients. So we're probably looking at much more subtle measures here than just there are good docs and bad docs. And that's where we need to go next. So some of the summaries of the findings. I say no strong evidence of quality improvement is being driven by physician-specific financial incentives. On the other hand, there are lots of other things going on in this organization at that time. There's very active quality improvement programs, very active work through their EHR, through alerts, et cetera. And that's going to affect everybody. And so the fact that we can't separate it doesn't matter, and the fact that physician-specific incentives don't matter because the whole system is working in that direction. Frequency doesn't matter. You know, on the other hand, maybe it's nice. You know, it costs an extra 43 cents per doctor per quarter to send out a check. It probably doesn't matter. And we actually did send it to them in the mail because we wanted them to open it and think about it. Within and across physician measures, there's a lot of stuff to look at here. We don't know what the answers are, but it's not like good docs and bad docs and somehow we'll find them, except for the older women. So in the context of other organizational and quality improvement measures, relatively small financial incentives. We're talking about 2 to 3% at a maximum. Why would you really expect a big effect here? On the other hand, that's how much they were willing to put on the table. And they pushed very hard against making the incentives very large. They felt it wasn't fair or equitable. They wanted people to do the right thing. They felt that incentives were small, were okay. Big incentives, they just didn't like the idea. And other kinds of organizational support, I think, are really important. Getting better, you know, maybe adding more staff would be better than paying the doctors an extra $3,000 or $4,000 a year. Some of the other things where we're going in the future is to try to find out, for example, whether race, ethnicity, and language differences account for some of the differences that are going on. They are measuring it. And one of the interesting questions here is whether it's discordance. It's not just language. Because, for example, a patient may have, a physician may have an English-speaking Indian patient and say, don't eat bread, and they're not translating that as don't eat rice or naan. So it's the culture as well as the language that we need to think about in this. Thank you.
All right, I see, I was gonna say one or two. Let's do three quick questions. I'll just take these first three hands. I think you were first. Stand up and face the group, maybe, yeah.
San Francisco, there are various community clinics that serve different communities. Well, African Americans tend to have lower HEDIS scores. So are we then going to penalize the clinics that are actually doing the most amount of work for the hardest populations but have the lowest scores? Or do you actually base it on race, ethnicity, and language, in which case how are you going to adjust for that?
Well, one of the questions that we'd be exploring is, if it is harder to get a good score when they're is a language discordance, or when the patient is of a may have a language problem. Okay, remember, almost all these patients are insured. Mm-hmm. Okay, then maybe you want to give extra points for extra time. Okay, or more importantly, where we're beginning to look at it is say, who are the doctors who are getting good quality for their patients where you would not expect them to because of their race, ethnicity, language issues, and then to actually go in there and videotape their exams and say, what are you doing right here, and how can we teach the other doctors how to do that?